Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Jeremy Zettelmeier, the director of Bruegel, and with me today are Simone and Georg, our foremost senior experts on energy. Simone and Georg, can you introduce yourselves, please?
Hello, my name is Simone Tagliapietra, and indeed, as Jeremy said, I'm a senior fellow working on energy and climate policy issues at Bruegel.
Yes, hello, my name is Georg Zachmann. I'm also a senior fellow at Bruegel, working also on energy and climate issues.
So, not surprisingly, as you know by now, the subject of this podcast is what's been going on in European energy markets, which have been under stress for some time, but particularly in the last few weeks. And then there are worries that things might get even worse as we get into the winter. So maybe to start out with, I would like to ask you, Simone and Georg, can you tell our listeners a little bit how that stress has manifested itself? So what has happened and why is it so serious?
Well, the European energy markets have seen a drastic mismatch of demand and supply during this year, and probably this will continue to be visible. And this mismatch has led to extremely high prices, both for electricity and gas. So we have seen now electricity wholesale prices reaching sometimes close to 1,000 euro per megawatt hour. To remind you, corresponding prices have been in past years in the order of 50 euro per megawatt hour. So sometimes drastic increases, and they are not only happening in the so-called day ahead market. So for short-term transactions and for trading on kind of weather-related and demand-related short-term issues, but also in the futures market. And the same we observe for natural gas. There, the demand-supply mismatches is quite visible with the strong decline of Russian flows. But the result here has also been that usual averages of 15 euro per megawatt hour for gas in the past have now turned into gas prices that are sometimes 200 or 300 euro per megawatt hour. So these are levels that are not only challenging traders, but they are also leading to massive social implications when they are tickering down to retail prices. And they are also challenging the integrity of energy trading, because governments want to intervene in these high prices, but also because companies are finding it very difficult to deal with the also quite high price jump. So sometimes prices fall by 30% within days.
And of course, the situation might even get worse in the winter, because exactly as Georg explained, we have this supply-demand mismatch. Let's remember here that this is mainly due to the fact that over the last months, Russia has cut off around two-thirds, if not even more, of its traditional supplies of gas to Europe. And so far, Europe has managed to compensate those massive lower volumes from Russia with alternative supplies, and namely LNG. So the storage refilling season in Europe is going pretty well. Our storages underground are full by 80% now, which, let's remember, was the target introduced by the European Commission by the end of October. So we are certainly in a good position, but we don't know how the winter is going to look like. We know that every year the profile of gas demand might be very different in the winter according to the temperatures. Now, we don't have full visibility now on whether this will be a cold or a warmer than usual kind of a winter. So we need to get prepared for a scenario where, for example, the heating season will be a significant one. So the risk looming ahead for Europe is that if we are not able to sufficiently reduce demand, both for gas and for electricity, we might not be able to meet our demand, and therefore we might indeed see rationing being a last resort option to be implemented by governments during the winter. So this is to say that more than the pricing dimension that has been mentioned by Georg and that is now at the top of the agenda of European policymakers, we continue to have a problem with the issue of securing our energy security of supply. And this is something that certainly represents a key dilemma for policymakers these days, how to tackle both these issues at the same time, because clearly there are trade-offs between them.
So Simone and Georg, if I understand correctly, policymakers are taking this very seriously. So I think there's a meeting tomorrow, even an informal meeting of energy ministers to discuss this. But before we get into sort of possible solutions, so what policymakers should be doing in Europe, I think it's maybe a bit, it may be important to understand the causes a bit more. So is this all about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the sanctions that were triggered by that? Are there deeper causes? One thing, of course, that is possibly a bit surprising is why we see this volatility in the gas prices now, when we are several months away from that invasion. So can you explain to our listeners a little bit what is causing this this stress?
Well, as we have described in our recent paper on the grand bargain for energy we need in Europe, there are different elements that have made this situation possible. First of all, we need to recognize that we have made some mistakes in the past with regard to our energy policy. We have let Russia becoming our predominant supplier for gas. Russia used to cover 40% of our imports, and the lack of alternatives is what has created the problem, because the problem was not only the predominance of Russia in the import portfolio, but was the lack of alternative gas import infrastructure, namely in countries like Germany. So this was an historical energy policy mistake, not to create alternatives, to over-rely on a single supplier, which is, I think, something that Europe now is learning in a very rough manner. And probably this will also be a lesson for the future with regard to other fields, such as raw materials for the green transition, etc. Then another element that brought us here is certainly a sort of long COVID syndrome that has characterized energy markets over the last months. During 2020 and 2021, we remember very well, we have seen periods of even negative oil prices, right? So during those tough periods, energy investments have been postponed because demand was dropping. And as you all know, energy takes long cycles to bring investments into projects and into delivery of oil and gas. And therefore, there was a certain mismatch globally between energy demand and supply once demand bounced back after the lockdowns from Europe to Asia to the United States. And then, more than this global dimension, I think there were also some Europe-specific, I would say, unfortunate coincidences that have also created this sort of perfect storm we are in. No? Because on the one hand, we have seen around half of the nuclear fleet in France going offline due to the need of undertaking extraordinary maintenance. And this has created a problem because France used to export electricity. And of course, this was not the case in the last months. And therefore, this created a further burden on the European electricity system, increasing further the demand for gas. And then we have had a very dry summer, the drought, possibly the worst in the last 500 years in Europe has seriously compromised the hydroelectric output during the summer, and this further pushed the demand for gas vis-a-vis the lower output from hydropower plants. And finally, the most important element of this perfect storm has been the Russian shock, and we have mentioned the historical policy mistakes with that regard.
So in a sense, not what was not completely anticipated, I think, and what has been the trigger of the nervousness of policymakers in the last few weeks is the fact that we have had these price extremes, right? So can you maybe explain why we have had these extreme prices when, you know, fundamentally not that much seems to have changed in the sense that, you know, the fundamentals of supply and demand are still roughly the same. You know, we have had the invasion of Ukraine. There has been, of course, additional cuts in Russian supply. But why would these cuts in a situation where Russia had already reduced supply lead to these extreme price movements?
The answer to that, I think, lies mainly in the gas market. So we have no additional volumes of gas that we can bring into Europe quickly, irrespective of the prices that we are willing to pay. So therefore, the supply elasticity for gas is extremely low, so very inelastic. That means that if you want to burn more gas for producing electricity, you are going to see very high electricity prices, and at the same time, that will also again push up gas prices even more. And the only thing that is balancing the market because of this lack of additional supply options is now on the demand side. So prices need to get to a level that bring demand down to a level that meets the available supply, because we cannot get easily more supply in the short term. Now, demand destruction happens only at very high prices in the European Union energy markets, because demand is sticky, and that's not necessarily due just to the willingness to pay of the individual consumers, but it's also due to contract structures and regulations in these markets. So a lot of the industrial energy consumers have long-term contracts and therefore are not confronted with the high prices that they are seeing. So therefore, they are producing as if the gas price was 30 euros per megawatt hour and as if electricity prices were 100 euros per megawatt hour. Even so, in fact, it's much higher. And for household consumers, the picture is very diverse in Europe. So there's different schemes how household electricity and gas prices are determined. But what have many of them in common is that household consumers do not really experience the wholesale prices and the scarcity on a wholesale market. And therefore, essentially markets that are anticipating the next winter are afraid that households will not save enough gas to make sure that we will be able to meet our demand in a relatively cold winter. So because of sticky demand and very limited supplies, we have these extremely high prices at the moment.
Thank you. That was very clear. So for those of you who have a supply and demand chart with intersecting curves in their heads, what seems to be going on here is that both the supply curve and the demand curve are extremely steep at the section when they're intersecting, right? So in technical parlance, they're both very inelastic, particularly the supply, but also the demand. And so if there are small movements in the supply curve, you get very large increases in prices. That's basically what's going on. Now, there's another puzzle, which has also been kind of typical for markets recently, in recent months, but particularly in the last few weeks, which is this phenomenon that not just the purchases of of energy. So industrial and household consumers seem to be suffering, but ironically, even some of the energy companies themselves, although, you know, in general, since their sales are tied to high prices, they should be benefiting. So how can an energy trader or an energy company get into trouble because or at a time when prices are extremely high? Georg, can you explain that a bit?
Well, it's very much due to the fact that prices have been extremely volatile in past months as well. So, I mean, we saw these extremely high price jumps up and down. And the worry essentially is that in the long-term markets, if you want to kind of lock in a certain price because you're a steel producer or whatever, you want to be sure that the guy with whom you sign your long-term contracts can deliver its energy. Now, if in the future the prices are again shifting a lot, you might be worried that your supplier might go bankrupt and might not be able to fulfill its supply obligation. And that risk increases, obviously, with the level of the prices and the volatility of the prices. So if you buy long term, you need some sort of insurance that your supplier is not going bankrupt. Now, markets have invented a solution to that problem in setting up a so-called central counterparty. And this central counterparty is essentially collecting collateral from the seller when he signs a long-term contract from the buyer. And this collateral moves with the prices to make sure that at any moment, if the seller goes bankrupt, the whole system does not explode, but the buyer can get the collateral, and from the collateral will be able on the market to buy again the amount of energy he has signed up for. So it's a very smart system. It has reduced the risk in the market and allowed long-term trading. The problem is that the collateral requirements are currently going through the roof and are really straining the liquidity of the sellers. So sellers on average might make huge profits, or in the future might make huge profits out of this thing. But currently, they have to post a lot of collateral. And accordingly, member states have started to essentially provide emergency liquidity to sellers of whom you would think they are in extremely good shape.
Thank you, Georg. Right. So that was, I think, very nicely explained. So the fundamental problem is that when expectations of future prices go up, right? And that's what's happened, right? So futures are through the roof. Then the buyers in these contracts, they seek protection because they expect extra protection, but because they have to deal with the possibility that in the future they might have to buy gas on a spot market, right, at extremely high rates. And so that protection has to be provided by the energy supplier. That would, in principle, benefit from that high price in the future, but of course, it needs to put up that extra protection today, and so that creates this tension that a company that, in principle, is benefiting from high prices because it needs to provide insurance to its customers, the buyers of the gas, has to put up this extra collateral, which might strain its financial capabilities in the short run. Did I summarize that correctly? Okay, wonderful. So that I think was the hardest part of this podcast. So everyone is nervous because of course, you know, like we said, in a strained market, small mismatches between supply and demand, because of the steepness of these supply and demand curves, can have these extreme implications that even potentially might affect financial stability. And if we then look into the winter, what we are all fearing is an even more extreme version of today's problem, right? So we get a supply shock or we get a demand shock because of a harsh winter. And then we get even higher prices, even more volatility, even more need for sellers to post collateral so that buyers can be reassured that they are going to be okay if the seller has problems delivering in the future. And this might actually be wiping out companies. So then what is the set of policy measures that you guys are proposing to take the tension out of the market? Because that's what I understand your paper does when you are calling for a grand bargain. And in what sense is this set of policy measures a grand bargain? So where is the give and take there? Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, so in our view, Europe can face the current situation only if every country puts at the table all the supply and demand options it has at its disposal in order to contribute not only to its own energy security, but also to the overall European energy security. In short, we are convinced that if European countries during this unprecedented situation are to take a nationalistic slash fragmented approach, we will be in trouble. On the contrary, if we all coordinate a united response, unlocking all the options we have available, we might get through these crises in a better position. So we have listed some policies, some actions that we consider to be important. The first of which is that all European countries should bring in forward every available supply side flexibility option it has. Now, this entails painful political compromises, because here we are talking about options such as prolonging the life of nuclear power plants that are due to be closed this year in Germany, and we know how this debate is controversial in the country. This entails, for example, that the Netherlands, a country that has the largest gas field in the continent, the Groningen gas field, might produce more gas, but in order to share these resources also with neighboring countries. But that will entail more earthquakes in the area of Groningen, more need for compensation to the local communities. So that's going to be politically troubling. This entails utilizing more coal for power generation, for example, in countries like Italy, instead of using gas, if in certain electricity systems we have a predominant role of gas in the electricity generation mix. So if everyone does something here, we might yield results at the European level. And with regard to the supply side, what we mentioned in our paper is also the need to push forward this idea of joint procurement of gas at the European level. One of the very first actions that was put in place by the Commission in the framework of REPowerEU was the creation of this energy platform that is supposed to be or to become a procurement tool in the future, possibly of gas and LNG. And this is important. It is important because if countries agree to buy gas through these joint procurement schemes, we might reduce the risk that EU unity is basically undermined, because member states compete with each other for limited supplies of gas in international markets. So all this is very important. And of course, we need to consider that while in the short term, also brown options are necessary, such as a greater utilization of coal, we should not compromise our energy transition. And by the way, rolling out renewable energy or energy efficiency solution now can really be also part of the solution, not only for the next couple of years, but really as a long-term decoupling of the European economy from fossil fuel imports. The second element of our bargain is demand reduction. All countries, in our view, should really commit to deliver the demand reductions that have for gas already agreed under the EU deal that was recently achieved. Now we might have coming up soon a new deal for electricity demand reduction with mandatory targets at the European level. There is a clear recognition that if Europe manages to reduce its gas consumption of the winter by 15%, we can go through the winter even without Russian gas. So 3/4 of the Russian supplies we have managed to compensate on the supply side. The remaining volumes that might well be cut off entirely, we need to compensate through demand reduction. And this is something we can do if we have the right policies in place to incentivize consumers, families, and businesses to reduce their gas and electricity demand. You can do that by paying families to save energy. So if this winter you have an energy consumption that is lower than last year, you might get rewarded by your government. You can have auction systems for industries to be incentivized to reduce their demand. And the more we reduce demand now and in an orderly manner, the less we risk rationing during the winter. So these are the two first elements of our bargain, and Georg will tell you about the next ones.
Yeah, and kind of following up on Simona, I mean, if we manage to get demand and supply better in order, also prices will come down on the European market back to levels that are much more sustainable for everybody. And one of the big challenges is that we would need some sort of moratorium of member states to not subsidize their energy consumption. It's very clear that each member state has an interest to give money to its industrial consumers or its household consumers to be able to maintain its consumption. But that is exactly the wrong answer, because that will result in a subsidy race between member states, because in the end, a German glass manufacturer will try to buy the gas at a certain price. Then he cannot afford it. The government gives him money. A Belgian company is then priced out of the market because the price increases because of the higher demand in Germany. And then the Belgian government has to give its glass manufacturers a corresponding subsidy. So a subsidy moratorium is extremely important, not to end up in a race that only pushes up prices and is a kind of the perfect beggarly neighbor policy. Now, this subsidy moratorium is closely linked to keeping essentially a political commitment to having energy markets open for cross-border flows. The big risk is that if some member states overdo it with energy subsidies inside their borders, then other member states that feel they cannot compete in the subsidy race might retaliate by reducing the capacity of cross-border lines. And that would be dramatic, because that would mean that overall the scarcity in the system will increase and the inefficiency in the system will increase. And that all countries in the end will become worse off. And I mean, we see so far no strong movement in this direction, but we are only ahead of the winter. And I think it's now the time to have both a commitment, no subsidy, and a second commitment, keep the borders open for market determined flows of electricity and gas. Now, the result of keeping the markets open might be that market prices remain relatively high in some countries, and those countries, if they are not allowed to subsidize, will need to find a way to help their population or some of their industries to survive the winter. But here, what is important is that those support schemes are not given for kind of maintaining consumption, but they are either handed out, as Simone explained, for reducing consumption, or they are at least handed out on a sort of lump sum basis in order to compensate the consumer, but not to compensate the consumption. And such schemes are available in different countries, but so far what we see very often, and I mean outside the EU borders, we see the UK proposal, for example, that is the exact opposite of this approach. Kind of freezing tariffs for consumers is not going to solve the crisis.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, just to summarize, you guys want to address first and foremost the fundamentals that led us to this situation. That is, you want to increase supply, you want to do it by purchasing gas on a common basis across the EU, which gives us more bargaining power. You want to do it by increasing energy supply, that is a substitute for gas, or indeed gas production itself within the EU. So German nuclear power plants, Dutch gas fields. And of course, you want to do it by reducing demand. And so the idea is, you know, we reduce demand, we increase supply, we basically pull those two curves that are so close to each other in a very steep range away from each other. And that will not just reduce prices, but also reduce the volatility of prices, because we got back into the more elastic areas of these curves. And then the additional point you're making is that we have to avoid having a race for scarce supplies within Europe, right? Because we end up all being worse off. And at the end, we end up spending a ton of subsidies neither consumers nor producers are better off for it. It's simply, you know, the law of whoever can provide the bigger subsidies more rapidly. Now, on the point about subsidies, if I understood you correctly, your point is not that all subsidies are bad, but that one needs to provide subsidies in a way that they maintain the incentive, or indeed create the incentive, reinforce the incentives to save on consumption. So what would be okay is simply a transfer to a household, say to a poor students, to poor pensioners, like in the latest German proposal, that is completely unrelated to energy consumption. What would be okay is something that actually is related to energy consumption, but with the opposite sign of a normal energy subsidy, namely one where the less you consume, the more money you get from the government. And then there's this tricky area of whether it is okay to actually keep prices down, right? And so from what I understand you saying is that this is generally not okay. So we should not try to engage in subsidies that maintain lower prices than the prices that reflect the current scarcity through subsidies. But, you know, there may be some exceptions. So maybe before I let you guys off the hook on this, can you maybe make one comment on the recent price break in the proposed by the German government in its scheme? So this is a form of price subsidies, which you guys generally oppose, but it seems structured in a way that is less susceptible to the problem that it encourages demand rather than encouraging savings in demand. Do you want to just walk us through that?
Yes. So in the past weeks, a number of proposals have been circulated by different member states, and the German proposal, which is very close to the leaked Commission proposal, is essentially capture the so-called inframarginal rent, that is the value that electricity producers would be making from selling electricity they produce at very low cost and selling it at very high prices, and take this money and give it to consumers in the form of a lump sum or in the form of so-called block tariff, so 80% of last year's consumption, they are still getting at the lower price. So that would not change the incentives of the producers if well designed, and it would not change the incentives of the consumers if well designed, still provides some sort of redistribution that allow. A more socially fair, but also politically acceptable outcome of these high prices. Because the political effect of pushing through 10 to 15 times higher prices to final consumers would not only be politically disastrous, but it would also potentially lead to a huge demand side shock, because a lot of people will not have any money to go to, I don't know, to the hairdresser or something. So the whole demand side will collapse in the economy. So therefore, it's quite sensible to seek solutions, and the German and the Commission solution are in principle the right way. In detail, there is a lot of challenges to be addressed in order to make it work.
Right. So basically, the way you solve this conundrum, that you want to both keep prices lower and induce greater savings, is that you keep prices low only on the volume of energy or electricity consumption that a frugal household, a household that actually tries to save, would consume, right? So you come up with some estimate of basic needs, right, which is on the low side of what people have consumed last winter, and that volume can be sold to consumers at lower prices, because if they go beyond that volume, they're going to face much higher prices, and hence additional consumption will be penalized, right? That is essentially the idea. The problem is to get this kind of estimate right of how much should be subsidized. Now, if it is too low, then you're not giving enough support to consumers. If it is too high, then you are not getting them to save properly. So it's a tricky business, but at least conceptually it does make sense. Now, there are other ideas. Please.
Yeah, Jeremy, I think the big challenge with this proposal is, I think, less on the handing out of the subsidy. I think the mistakes that you can make there are largely acceptable, but the big challenge is collecting the money. So my assessment would be that this sort of capturing inframarginal rents is super complicated, because the electricity markets that kind of already cleared sometimes years ago in the futures market, you will be very hard pressed to find who essentially is making these windfall profits that one want to take away, and to do it in a legally and in a technically possible way. So I would expect that governments can go in that direction and capture some of that, but there is then, if they do it too aggressively, there are then also efficiency losses that you're going to encounter. And one potential solution to this would be to have essentially three pillar approach to collect the money. You take a bit of money from the government, so direct fiscal support. You take a bit of money from the profit taxes of the companies that will at some point post higher profits and will be taxed on that, and then you will try to get as much as possible from these inframarginal rents. And it's not a pure science. It's going to be an art, and it's going to be quite difficult and different in the different member states. But that's how I would see at the moment the most pragmatic way forward.
Okay, so we are almost out of time, but this sort of falls into a category of proposals that you guys are not necessarily pushing, but you are not disagreeing with them either. And indeed, you know, some forms of these proposals can be, if one puts enough art in it, as you said, could be useful. But then there are other proposals that could be more destructive, and they have to do with sort of attempts to interfere in the price mechanism at the wholesale level. You know, the idea of decoupling wholesale prices from on the gas market from electricity prices. Can you guys maybe give a summary of what these proposals are and why you disagree with them, if you do indeed disagree with them?
Yes. So the proposals that are out there are trying to interfere in the wholesale market and try to bring down either the price of gas and or the price of electricity in the wholesale market in order to reduce the profits of the producers and also reduce the pain of the consumer. So that's what they all have in common. But then in the details, they differ. And what is very important to say up front is that I still don't understand all the details and all the mechanics because we are intervening here in a highly complex market. I mean, this market has some 2 billion contracts every year. It's having contract structures in very different durations, actors in different countries. So it's a very complicated market. And if you interfere in its small details on how you implement something, even if it's the same broad concept, will matter a lot. So take it with a grain of salt. But the one proposal that is out there is the so-called Spanish exception. It's a policy that has been introduced by the Spanish and Portuguese government. And this is essentially giving electricity producers or gas-fired power plants a subsidy for the gas they are buying. And so they see lower gas prices, and these lower gas prices allow them to produce electricity at lower cost, and then they have to bring this electricity to the market at lower cost. And accordingly, the electricity price on the Spanish market has dropped quite a bit. So in the first round, effect has been positive and as intended. But then there are all sorts of issues with that. First, gas consumption in Spain went up quite a bit. Also, coal-fired power plants have been driven out of the market and needed to be subsidized afterwards to come back into the market. Higher gas consumption led to higher gas prices. So for gas consumers, it has not been a good policy. And the system has been leaking. That means that the cheaper electricity has then essentially moved over the border to France, which you might find desirable. But if you implement it on the European continental scale, some member states will find it quite hard to justify that they are putting up money for cheaper electricity that is flowing to their neighbors. So I'm relatively skeptical that this proposal will make sense on the European level. A very different proposal is the so-called Greek proposal. And the Greek proposal essentially says, okay, we have a market, we create a market for cheap electricity. So that's renewables, lignite, nuclear. They're kind of trading electricity in this market. The price of that will be low. And you have a market for expensive electricity, so gas and maybe coal, and the price in that will be high. And then you pool these two markets together and you get on average a lower price than the one before. One challenge is, of course, if you bring prices down, then demand will go up. And then there is the big challenge is that this is going to be a very, very intrusive mechanism because it essentially requires you to make sure that everybody is trading at the same market in order to not allow some bypassing, kind of finding an arbitrage opportunity between those two markets. So we will, with this, end up with a completely different market design, and rushing that through in an emergency situation seems highly risky. So that's two of the many proposals that are circulating. And as you can hear from me, I am rather worried because these machines, this electricity market is a very well-designed and very complex mechanism, and kind of knee-jerk interventions need to be considered extremely carefully.
Thank you. Simone, can you just close the loop for us and sort of give us a sense of what the way forward should be at this point?
But I would like to take it from what Georg just said. We are in an emergency situation where the risk might be that we rush for emergency measures, compromising our, for example, electricity market design on the one hand, or our emission trading system on the other hand, because at the same time, we also see pressures about mothballing our emission trading system, which is the European Union main climate policy tool. So the risk is to rush into emergency solutions that might derail institutional work that we have done for more than 20 years. So I think what the Commission has as an approach, and it's a prudential approach, to say the long-term reforms will have to be done with the time that is necessary to do them. So, for example, the electricity market design will be revised next year. For now, let's try to focus on what can be simple, implementable, pragmatic measures to try to provide a solution to the problem over the next weeks, because the problem is now, and we cannot reinvent, you know, a whole system that took years to be made. So this is the difficult balancing act that policymakers have now to face. And we need to be very clear. There is no silver bullet. Price caps, etc., are not going to solve our problem. They can mitigate part of it, but it is only through a mix of efforts and solutions that we might get there through this winter and next winter without Russian gas. This entails efforts that politically will not always be easy, but that's exactly the reason why, if everyone does an important effort on its own, the final solution will be the efficient one. And that's exactly why we need a grand bargain on energy, as we have tried to put forward with our paper.
So if I might briefly follow up on Simone here. So the impression we got when from looking on the different options is that many of those options are for the individual country quite painful if considered in isolation. But if one country, for example, allows some gas-fired power plants to be transformed again to oil or fuel switching, ignoring some emission standards in production to switch away from gas to even coal, the country is not going to like it. The environmentalists in this country are not going to like it. The population is not going to like it. And the benefit of that will largely appear in the overall European market. So everybody will benefit from that while the cost is falling on one country. And the same for demand side measures, the same for keeping the market open, the same for not subsidizing. And all this essentially means that everybody pays in for the greater good for everybody else, and therefore we need to find a joint solution where we put all those options in the head from the different sides, and the challenge will be to find a balanced solution that not shortchanges some of the member states too much. And here the question is, to which degree there can also be some fiscal transfers in one form or another to essentially enable in a better way to get to solutions where those that have cheaper options to help everybody else are incentivized to bring them to the European table.
Thank you, Simone. Thank you, Georg. And thank you to our listeners for enduring the complicated substance of energy policy in Europe today. We hope that European institutions will be strong enough to generate the cooperative solution that Georg and Simone have argued for. You can read the paper we just discussed, as well as other analysis by our scholars, on our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time. Bye-bye.